Hello, hello, hello.
Peter, I'm going to make this introduction very short because I only met him a half hour ago, and I don't want us to get into a kind of artificial situation where I'm trying to remember things from his resume, okay? David is here primarily because he's doing a NEA on-site evaluation for theaters in Seattle. And he's going to talk to you a little bit about what that means and how he got in the position to do these. But our real interest and kind of focus is with David's own work as an artist, as a theater person. David attended the Yale School of Drama, was there when one of our earlier speakers was there. You lived right downstairs from Ben Moore, is that what you told me?
Upstairs.
Upstairs from Ben Moore. Since that time, David has been working as a writer, as a literary manager, as a dramaturg, and as a production dramaturg. He's worked at some of the most important theaters in this country, including the Taper, the Arena Stage, New Dramatists in New York, and most recently has decided to embark on a full-time career as a writer and translator. So I think that there are a variety of, can you not hear me? Oh, I'm sorry. I think there are a variety of things that David will share with us that will be of interest to you. And I've also asked him if we can allow some time at the end for questions, because I think that perhaps one of the things that can be beneficial for us is in these sessions is if we give time for you folks to ask some questions. So, Dave.
Thanks. Let me know in the back if you can't hear, or anywhere if you can't hear, because sometimes I'm a little soft, I'm told. The subject of doing on-site reporting for the National Endowment of the Arts Theater Program may sound a little esoteric to you. It would have sounded esoteric to me. I would have thought, who cares? What is this anyway? It's someone who comes in from out of town, sees one or several theaters in production in a particular city, talks to the people who run the theaters and who may have something to do with the production, writes a report, sends it in to the National Endowment of the Arts in Washington, and gets a check back in the mail. What does this have to do with the creation of art? Well, what it has to do with primarily is money, which has a lot to do with the creation of art in this country. As you know, there are a lot of different ways in which theaters survive in this country. Some of it is through box office income, but that only accounts for, if you're dealing with a not-for-profit theater, from between, say, 40 to 70% of the total budget of the theater. Where does the rest come from? You only have a fixed number of seats in your theater. You can't raise your ticket prices so high that nobody can afford to come. If you're a commercial theater and you're not eligible for subsidy, that's what you have to do, which is why commercial theater tickets usually cost about twice as much as tickets in subsidized theaters. And subsidized or not-for-profit theaters in this country include most of the interesting theaters in the United States, as opposed to, you laugh, you should go to some of the others, as opposed to what are essentially commercial theaters or rental houses. All the Broadway theaters are rentals. You go in there with a package, okay? You rent the space for X number of weeks, and you guarantee them that income. And you sink or swim at the box office. That's why you have to wait for the words of Frank Rich or whoever else is reviewing for the Times to tell you whether you live or die. Okay. But we're not dealing with that here. We're dealing with another kind of theater, another kind of structure that allows theater to be something more than commercial entertainment, a structure which, theoretically at least, allows theater to be considered as an art form. Not that it doesn't entertain, but it doesn't stop there. It doesn't just entertain. It might do other things as well. keeping you awake after a large meal might be one of them. Anyway, theaters are organized on a not-for-profit basis. That simply means that any increase in income that they have over what they expend goes back into the theater rather than to investors, okay? So that if a theater operates at a surplus, it's in good shape. If a theater operates at a loss, it has to make up that loss somehow. Well, you can only raise your ticket prices so high, as I said. You can only renovate your theater so many times. You can only jam so many seats into the space at your disposal without destroying the aesthetic of it. I mean, you can build a 3,000-seat theater. The Schuberts have done it in many, many cities. But if you've ever sat in the last row of a 3,000-seat theater and tried to figure out what was happening on the stage, you know why that is not a very interesting aesthetic experience. But let's say you have a 200 or 300 or 400-seat theater. Your income, aside from the box office, can come from any one or most of several different places. Donations from corporations, from foundations, from individuals, possibly some income from an endowment that you may yourself set up. If you're a theater, you can ask people to give you several million dollars, let's say, and then the income from that will subsidize your operating budget. That's happening more and more at the larger theaters. And then there are government sources of income. Now, when people hear the notion of government subsidy of the arts, the tendency is to think that the government pays for everything. Well, that's not so. The average rate of subsidy of all the theaters in the United States that qualify for it, which is about 170 theaters, is between 3% and 5% of the theater's total budget. The purpose of it is to allow the theaters to, the idea is to take some pressure off the continual necessity of making it at the box office. The idea is that if there is some portion of your budget which is subsidized based on the quality of the work, that you can then therefore experiment. You can do new plays. You can do interesting, strange productions of older plays. You can, in other words, keep up with the state of the art. The model for this is theaters in Europe, which are often run by the state or by the city that they're in, and they are tend to be subsidized up to perhaps 80 or 85% of their budget. So we're in a little bit more primitive state than that, with only 3 to 5% subsidized, okay? Now that can mean anything ranging from $7,500 up to $300,000. $300,000 is the limit currently for a theater that may have a $10 million budget, like the Shakespeare Festival in New York. All that by way of introduction to what it is I'm actually doing in Seattle right now. I moonlight as a consultant to the theater program of the National Endowment of the Arts, which is the federal agency that's charged with finding those groups in the arts, specifically in the theater, that are deserving of subsidy, and writing reports on the work that helps the panel decide which groups to give the money to and how much. So I have this great second job. This is your tax dollars at work, folks. Any money that you pay in federal taxes goes to pay me to go to the theater. Thank you. It's great. Really, I fell into this. I didn't know there were such things, but it happened that I found out. So what I do is I get a list of, I don't know, 12, 15 theaters all around the country. Ideally, several of them will be in one city because that's only efficient. And in Seattle, I'm here to see four theaters, ACT, The Rep, New City, and, Tacoma, which is not strictly speaking in Seattle, but from Washington, it all looks the same to us. Okay. So, you knew that, didn't you? You suspected it anyway. Okay, so in 4 days, I go to see four shows. talk with the people who run the theaters, as I said, write a report on what I see, and send it in. Now, you may ask, how does one get a job like this? What is it that makes the government pay to put this bozo on a plane and send him 3,000 miles away from his home to see shows? I mean, that sounds wonderful. At least it sounds wonderful to me, which is why I continue to do it. I've worked in the theater in general for a long time, the professional theater, for the last 12 years. Prior to that, I worked in academic theater, teaching at San Jose State, University of California at Davis, and one or two other places for short terms. And the director of the theater program at the National Endowment used to be a man by the name of Arthur Ballot, whose name you may know as the man who founded and ran the Office for Advanced Drama Research during the 60s. Now, the Office for Advanced Drama Research, quite consciously, was made to sound like a federal office. It is not. What it was an outfit that Arthur read a lot of new plays, unproduced plays, and he would send the ones that he liked to theaters all around the country, which paid him for this service, and then they would produce the plays. This got the playwrights their first production in many cases, and got the theaters, which were then not as familiar as they are now with new material, got them some connection with people who were just starting to get into the writing business. Well, I knew Arthur through this because I'd worked at the Mark Taper. And when he became head of the theater program, I heard about these strange people who came around once a year to look at a performance of a production and then wrote about it for money. And yet who weren't critics. So I called him up and said, can I do this? He said, send me a resume. So I did, and he called me back and he said, go to this theater. So that was 1979, and I went to the theater and I wrote about it, and I guess they liked it because I've been doing it for 6 years, 7 years. And tonight I will go to the 204th theater that I've done this way. I also go to the theater for pleasure when I'm not working, maybe different theaters. And what a job like this does is teach you what the incredible range and diversity of American theater really is. Because you don't just see the theaters that get funds, you see the theaters that apply for funds, and it's not the same group. There are theaters that range from the New York Shakespeare Festival down to the Mobile, Alabama Children's Theater. And some of them are equity theaters, some of them are non-equity theaters. Some of them do traditional classic plays, some of them do all new plays. Some of them do performance art. Some of them do puppetry. I went to see the Big Apple Circus a couple of weeks ago. They're applying for a grant. There's a controversy at the moment over whether a circus that has animals is as fundable as a circus which does not have animals. So you see how arcane it can get. Now, what happens to these reports that I write is that they go to the theater program staff. And each theater makes an application every year, which includes their budget, some of where they put that money, the artistic director's statement, that is why the theater exists artistically. And that whole package is given out to people on the theater panel, all of whom are theater professionals. Judgments on funding are made not by bureaucrats, but by artists. And of course, when their own application comes up, they have to leave the room. They can't vote on it. So 15 people will sit in a room for 5 days in March, going over 400 applications, ranking them in order of artistic quality, artistic merit, based on the reports, and their own knowledge of the theaters, because a lot of the people who are on the panel also do this on-site reporting. And then they give out the money. The money is appropriated every year by Congress. and the amount can increase or decrease depending on political matters. But politics theoretically is left outside the room when funding decisions are made. Now, I was on the panel last year. I hope to be on it again this year. I can tell you it is absolutely grueling, exhausting, invigorating 5 days of madness. Your eyes turn 5 different colors reading through 400 applications and trying to figure out within certain budget categories which of the theaters are more deserving of support than the theaters that are not. And the criterion for that is quite simply artistic merit, which, as you know, is perfectly quantifiable and objective. Well, it isn't, really. It's very subjective. So a lot of it is comparison to, for me anyway, it's comparison to other theaters I've been to, comparison to other theaters I've seen, comparison to the kind of theater I would like to see. There are a number of questions that I ask myself when I do this kind of work, and I found that other people have worked their way to these questions as well. One of them being, would I rather stay home and watch Dynasty? It's not a simple question. If the answer is yes, the theater's in trouble. Because why should anybody pay to go and see something in the theater when they can sit at home and get more entertainment, okay? If it's less entertainment in the theater, they're not setting their sights high enough, or they don't have the artistic talent to do any better than that. Second question, if this theater were producing this play in an international festival, would I be ashamed to admit that I'm an American? Now, the reason I ask that question is because every theater, every not-for-profit theater in the United States is scrambling for money and thinking about money all the time. And a lot of times, the search for money gets in the way of the search for art, simply because there's only 24 hours in a day. It's not that artists, American artists, are less artistic than they are other places. Far from it. It's just that you only have so much time and so much energy to devote to doing the work. And the purpose of subsidy is to give you more time to do the work. For instance, in Europe, where subsidies are very high, rehearsal periods are not the standard American 3.5 to 4 weeks. They can be up to 6 months, 8 months, 10 months. Think about that. If the work needs more rehearsal, it gets it. They do not put shows in front of the public till they are ready to be seen. Sound like a luxury? Sure. All this time, the artists are paid. In many countries, they're civil servants. In many countries, unfortunately, along with the subsidy, you get direction about what material you may or may not produce from a Ministry of Culture. You can get 10 months rehearsal of a play in the Soviet Union. But if the censor comes to see a dress rehearsal and doesn't like it, it does not open. Okay? So you've been working, but it's ultimately rather frustrating. So you give a little here, you get a little there. Here, you're at the mercy, basically, of market forces. And I don't think the levels of subsidy, in general, are high enough to affect that basic problem, that whatever an audience, the audience that the theater already has, wants to see, that's what you have to give them. Or if you offer them something different, be prepared for a lag time between the time you do the play and the time they get hip to what it is you're doing. So it's very hard to innovate. Not impossible, just difficult. It's very hard to offer things that may be great art but are not popular. There's a tremendous problem in this country in people not understanding the difference between popularity and quality. If a lot of people want to see it, it must be good, right? Well, maybe. But maybe if only a few people want to see it, it's good for those few people, and in 50 to 100 years, everybody will take it as a matter of course. There was a time when the standard naturalistic play about families in crisis in a living room was absolutely innovative. And if you go back and you look at the reviews of those early productions, especially plays by Shaw and Ibsen. The critics hated them. Audiences walked out in droves. And you look at this stuff now and you think, what could it have been here that got people so angry and so upset? And now we take it for granted. That doesn't mean that it's always been that way. It just means that now we're used to it. That's the standard mode in which people write. So people who write in different modes now, who say, okay, we've got film and TV, what can the theater do that is only theatrical, that only this medium can provide? The answers to that may not be quite as accessible to a mass audience as they are to artists or people interested in the field. Well, that's normal. That's just a routine in history, that you start out with something that looks strange and outrageous and crazy. And in 15 or 20 years, it becomes chic, then it becomes dated, then passé, then boring, and then finally it's something that, you know, your parents will take you to see. Isn't that a terrible thing of me to say? I apologize. It's not always true. It's just that whenever you come into the world, you think, okay, the avant-garde, this is it, this is wonderful, and all that other stuff is old hat, forget about it. Well, you go along another few years and you realize that there's a new avant-garde, and those people are saying the exact same thing about the work you're doing. So the mechanism must really be, what's the whole universe of art? What can you do with an old play that makes an audience look at it as if they had never seen it before? Let's say it's a play that everybody has read in high school and therefore hates. What are the three? Macbeth, Romeo and Juliet. What's the third one?
Julius Caesar.
I don't know, there must be a factory where they turn out these texts, right? Those three were the ones I had to get through in high school, okay? So if you see a production that's just like the production you imagined in high school, it's going to affect you in one way. If you see a production that shows you a side of these plays that you never thought existed and that hits you where you are right now, which do you think you will perceive as having the greatest impact, and which do you think you will perceive as being the more artistic work? Well, the purpose of subsidy, both public and private, the real purpose of it is to allow the artistic institutions to pay the artists to find the time to create works that do not simply justify the feelings and thoughts and emotions that you already have, but to create a new world for you, an imaginative world that may be very, very different from the one that you expect when you walk into the theater, but which is better than your expectations. It's a wonderful surprise. This is how it works at its best. And that kind of quality is what the endowment, at least the theater program, says it wants to fund. Well, that's the ideal. Reality, as usual, falls somewhere short of that, so we do what we can. Just as each theater produces as well as it knows how, given the circumstances. And you have to kind of believe, as I've come to believe, that when people do bad work, it's not because they don't want to do good work, it's because something gets in the way of it. And you try to identify that obstacle, whatever it may be, and remove it. At one extreme, there is a theater in this country which was doing very exciting new work, and its audience was rather conservative and stodgy, and they didn't like that, so they left. About 40% of them did not renew their subscriptions. Traditionally, when that happens, the next season at a theater becomes very conservative because it wants to bring all those people back into the theater. They need that money for operating expenses. Instead, the theater just kept right on doing what it was doing and, in effect, fired one audience and hired another. Now you think, now that's brave, right? Why don't other theaters emulate this? Real good reason why. That's the American Repertory Theater, which is located at Harvard University. And they are subsidized to some degree by the university itself, so that they could afford to take that kind of risk. and wait until the audience, which was out there, but which never went to the theater, because every time they'd been to the theater in the past, they'd been bored out of their minds, to say, something hot is going on at ART, let's go see what it is. And they responded, and eventually they subscribed. And now they're doing very well. But it took some time. It does take guts. It takes guts to be in the business to begin with. But you knew that. Okay, that's all I have to say about that. Any questions? Yeah.
Do you notice a particular kind of theater or a kind of innovation you notice yourself pushing for or the ANA pushing for?
I would say the notion of innovation in general, that is, if there is a bias to NEA funding, and I think there is, it's that theaters that do standard work in standard ways are not judged as highly as theaters that either do new work consistently or do classical plays in contemporary fashion. Now, it is possible to have a perfectly historically accurate reproduction of a classic play. But in general, the ones that I've seen have not been particularly emotionally persuasive. And I've also found through my studies of theater history that they are only accurate selectively. That is, when you think of Shakespeare as Shakespeare was meant to be done, what you're thinking about really is the 19th century Shakespeare, not a 16th or 17th century Shakespeare. For one thing, you will never see a standard Shakespeare done with all men the way it was done in Shakespeare's time. You will have actresses on the stage. Why? Because if actresses aren't cast in those plays, they tend to get very upset. Who can blame them? But that is not, strictly speaking, accurate. It's only selective. So, if, however, someone, you know, you can't just tell by looking at a list of plays whether they're innovative or not. You have, that's why they send us out. You have to go and see.
There seems to be a special, isn't there a special area of funding right?
Yeah, there's an inter-arts. See, the in addition to the theater program, the endowment has a music program, opera, musical theater, design, inter-arts, as I said, various others. And it's possible for a theater, if it's smart and has its act together, to qualify for funding under several of these different programs. But what I'm concerned more with the theater program, because that's the one that I review for. Yeah.
I'm curious as to, in your list of four theaters that you're seeing in this area, three here, one to come.
Yeah.
You're going to direct, which, as far as I know, is the largest theater in town. It's got the largest operating budget this year. As opposed to the bathhouse, Pioneer Square, empty space, etc. It's because those theaters didn't apply.
No, it's because someone else will review them.
Okay.
I don't have all the theaters in Seattle.
Okay.
I was here earlier, and I went to see Intiman, an Intiman production. I'm doing these particular four because I can manage it, and someone else must have the bathhouse and the group and all the others and the space. I hope they're saving those for me, because then I can come back to Seattle next year and do all those other theaters. No, to apply, a theater has to have been in operation, I think it's 3 years, and be qualified as a not-for-profit institution. And I'm not sure what the other criteria are. I get my assignments through the theater program. There is a great care taken, by the way, on the panel to make sure that good small theaters get funded, that they do not get lost, because they don't have the resources that the good large theaters do. They don't have the PR staff, they don't have the development staff often. What they do have sometimes is really terrific work. And it's sort of a special project of the program to make sure that they're funded. We try to ignore the large theaters that do bad work, and we try to ignore the little theaters that do bad work. Good work is not a function of size, it's a function of vision. Oh yeah, no question. The panel is composed largely of artistic and managing directors of theaters that already get funding. Different size theaters, and not always artistic or managing directors. I mean, I'm not one of those, and I'm on the panel. I guess I was put on, A, because I'm a dramaturg, and B, because I've done a lot of on-sites. So I know the field, and they wanted some of that expertise. In the past, they've had people from all different areas in the theater, designers, technicians, playwrights, whatever. They try to mix large theaters and small theaters. They try to mix sexes, races, ethnic backgrounds, and points of view as much as they can, given 15 people. Obviously, each person has to fulfill 5 or 6 of those categories. It's the theater program director makes the choices, which I think then are approved by the chair of the endowment, who is Frank Hodsell at the moment. The theater program also is without a head at the moment because Ed Martinson left that job to become managing director at the Guthrie Theater, and they're still looking for his replacement. But the 15 people on the panel, you're only appointed for a year. You may serve for 3 years, and then that's it. Then you have to get off for at least a while, because they like to mix it up. And over the years, it's felt, each person's biases will be canceled out by everyone else's. There's a lot of discussion at these meetings. And changes in funding, except for either being brought into the program, tend to happen very slowly. The idea was that the good theaters should be increased more rapidly than the bad theaters were cut back if there was overfunding. So that the package of material that you get not only has this year's reports, one or two reports, and some theaters get two reports, but also a précis of the reports of the 2 years prior to that. So it's not a perfect system, obviously, but they do try to cover all the bases. Just like saying, why is it that a theater has to be judged on one performance of one production? That's terrible. And the answer I got to that question was, yes, that is terrible. The only thing worse would be, if you rent your space, that's fine. If you tour, that's fine too. It's the company that's important. It's the work that the theater does, whether it works in its own space all the time or really doesn't matter. Yeah. 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 I wish I could say it was for all of them, but it's not true. You're absolutely right. It is a profession in search of a job description. And nobody quite knows in the professional theater what to do with us, and we all have different skills anyway. I think it's not unreasonable that the good time I had working with a Romanian director on The Wild Duck, I had because this guy was European, and he'd been working with dramaturgs since he was a little boy. They have them over there. It's a recognized profession, and no one is threatened by it. in this country, I think, because many directors have been trained to be their own dramaturgs or to solve all problems themselves. They don't quite know how to use a person who comes in carrying a dictionary and a big stick, as an artistic director once put it to me. That was her vision of a dramaturg. First of all, because the word is ugly, and second, it's German, and second, because if you come in crusading and saying, I'm going to reform the American theater, and I'm going to be the conscience of your theater, what do you think their response is? Get out! Leave us alone. We've been doing fine. Okay? Well, in their softer moments, they know they have not been doing as well as they would like to do. There is a tremendous gap between yearning and achievement, artistically. And maybe the dramaturg is one of the people who can contribute to improving that by working on the text, by being around for a director just to talk to. The person who is not an actor, who is not a designer, who is not a playwright, just to be there and watch and be somebody to share problems with. Now, if that sounds like I'm talking about a relationship rather than a title, you're absolutely right. Dramaturg is not a title, it's a function. And there is no dramaturg in a production situation without the director, or in some cases where the playwright is there and living, a playwright. That is, the smallest unit is not the individual, but the couple, as Brecht might have said. One of the things about being a dramaturg is that you get to quote Brecht at almost every opportunity. But I was pretty depressed about the profession, saying it's not going to work in this generation. It's going to come out of Yale, where they're training dramaturgs and directors in tandem, and maybe they'll feel good about it. There'll be teams crisscrossing the country, but going in on a one-shot basis, or being the person who spends most of his time shuffling scripts around an office and then has to show up for rehearsals, this is just, they're going to try, but it's just not going to happen unless the chemistry is right. So I thought, until a Romanian director named Lucian Pintilie, who directed an opera in Vancouver this summer, if any of you may have seen that, it caused a big stir. I can't even remember what the title of it was. Anyway, he is, they call him the Romanian director with the talent. He and Liviu Chule and Andrei Serban, and there's another one too, his name I can't remember, have brought to the American theater a tremendous visual sense and a way of looking at material that is informed by the political situation in your own country, which doesn't change the words of the plays, but it makes it much more powerful because it gets to, at least in the case of Tartuffe, which he did at the Guthrie and then at Arena, and in the case of The Wild Duck, which he did at Arena Stage, made what everybody, what a lot of people was afraid was going to be another boring production of boring old Ibsen's boring old Wild Duck, an absolute revelation. Now, I worked with him on the text. He had directed the play in France, where he lives, in French. And he had his own translation in French. We had to turn that into English. And he came in with a literal translation. And he and I sat down in my dining room for several days with the text, the French text, the Norwegian text, a Norwegian-English dictionary, because neither of us speaks Norwegian, a German dictionary, a couple of French translations, other French translations, several English translations, and a German translation of The Wild Duck. And we went back and forth, talking mostly in French, for several days. And we would argue, we would squabble, we would agree, we would disagree, we would say, what about this? We would try something. He'd say, no, that's not exactly what I want. I need something else here. Well, what's happening here? Well, there's a huge stage space here. Gina is crossing the stage back and forth all the time. The play is not about the men. The men are superficial. It's about the work that's done in that house. Oh, okay. I see what you mean. Now, if he had not had a visual sense of how the place looked, if he had not said to the people at Arena Stage, you're going to have to tear out the back wall of your small theater because I need more space upstage. And if they didn't believe in him enough to give him that, so that the corridor between the back wall of the Krieger Theater and the shop was removed, and a kitchen was built back there, that being the kitchen of the Ekdahls, if there had not been a huge iron staircase built diagonally from the stage floor right up to the top of the flies, past where you could see it. Because the attic, if you read the stage directions for the Wild Duck, the attic is supposed to be, where they have the menagerie, is supposed to be built upstage. Not this time. This time it was built over. You couldn't see it, but you could hear it. And what happened was, whenever the men went up there to mess around, and Mrs. Ekdahl is downstairs cooking or cleaning or doing her husband's work or whatever she has to do to survive, and this is part of her routine, they would make some kind of scuffle up there, and one of the chickens up there would lay an egg, and the egg would fall out and crack on the floor. And she'd have to clean it up. Okay? Feathers would come down every once in a while. And finally, at the end, when Hedwig shot herself, she fell out. Upstage, a body down. We didn't use an actress for that. We used a dummy, which was known backstage as Deadvig. Now, I'm not telling you everything about the production, because a lot of it just takes too long, but what it did was rediscover the life that is in a classic text. And if a director has the vision to do that, then it's a joy for a dramaturg to work with that director to say, okay, in order to serve that vision, because only in serving that vision do you genuinely serve Ibsen, the English has to sound like this, and you give several alternatives, so that it does not sound like a translation, God forbid. It sounds like people in a situation speaking about what is moving them at that moment, just as people do in any play written in English, any good play. So production dramaturgy for me there was a combination of aesthetic and practical and moral choices, which I was able to make all at once, working with this incredibly generous, brilliant man. And all the other dramaturgical situations that I am in from now on have that standard to come up to, or at least to try to approach. And I know it's not going to be easy, but that made it worthwhile. That made 12 years of eating dirt worthwhile. For a while. Okay. Yes?
As money gets more scarce, it seems that the not-for-profit theater is battling the problem of becoming increasingly elitist. And the president of TCB wrote about this program in the 60s that was very short-lived, that got parents to go to the theater maybe for the first time, and
You know, that seems to be the hardest perception to get through people's heads. That, to quote Zelda Fitchhandler, the purpose of a theater is not to recoup an investment, but to recoup some corner of the universe, like the library, an art gallery, museums, universities, all those things which are routinely subsidized as a matter of course. The problem is that those other institutions don't have a commercial component, not really. The theater does, and what's worse, in this country, the commercial component came first. So that most people's notion of what a theater is a dinner theater, or a place where people do things at night after their real day jobs are over. They're amateurs. Or they're stars, and therefore, you know, they're outrageously paid, and why should we subsidize them? Well, none of that applies to the sort of meat and potatoes not-for-profit theaters. But again, it's a slow process. Things can be changed, but only if political perceptions about what the nature of something really is. If enough people want the arts to be subsidized, they will be subsidized. Why? Because people vote. And when Reagan tried to cut the NEA out of existence and then tried to cut the budget, he didn't get very far. Why? Because a lot of people raised hell. And he thought, what, all this noise over this teeny tiny amount of dollars, and believe me, it is teeny tiny in comparison to other things. Forget it, I've got other fish to fry. So he moved on. And what you have is a combination of problems, that the cost of doing business just has risen. The cost of putting a show on is getting higher and higher. So that the only way a theater can stay open to all strata of society, or even a few strata of society, is by keeping its ticket prices relatively low. And relatively has changed a lot. When I was in college, which is not all that long ago, they made jokes about seats to Fiddler on the Roof being $9. That was the top. Top for a Broadway musical now is $50 to $55. That's a big jump. So that when people think about going to the theater, if they don't make it a habit, let's say it's a special deal, they're thinking about dinner, babysitters, parking, transportation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, plus the ticket cost. So if you pay $55, you better have $55 worth of entertainment or some kind of thing coming at you. And that is a heavy burden to bear. Too heavy, I think. You have to stop, right?
Thank you very much.
No, because they couldn't be here today.